Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Einstein once said, "Make everything as simple as possible, but no simpler." Einstein could have been talking about Brian Greene. The Washington Post has called Brian Greene the single best explainer of abstruse scientific concepts in the world. He's the best-selling author of The Fabric of the Cosmos, The Hidden Reality, as well as his breakout work, The Elegant Universe, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in General Nonfiction, won Britain's top prize for a book on science, and has sold more than 1 million copies worldwide. His books have been made into PBS television Nova miniseries, and Greene continues to find new ways to bring the latest science to wider audiences in compelling ways. He's coming to Memphis on March 5th to give a lecture at Rhodes College titled "The Cosmos, From the Big Bang to the End of Time." I'm so happy to have him with me on Counterpoint today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Brian, as co-founder and director of Columbia's Institute for Strings Cosmology and Astroparticle Physics, you're exploring string theory's implications for theories of cosmology. These are some of the most complicated and interesting ideas in theoretical physics today. But before we get into some of these ideas, you obviously spend a lot of your time working to explain these ideas to general audiences in new and compelling ways. Can you tell us why explaining the history and ideas behind theoretical physics is so important to you? And tell us about some of the ways in which you're doing this.
Basically, it's because I wanted my mom to understand what it is that I do. And I've failed miserably at that particular task, but luckily others have found that some of the things that we've written about allow them a window onto some of the most spectacular insights and discoveries that our species has accomplished. And it always struck me as tragic that there was this group of individuals working so hard to push the boundaries of understanding, and simply because the language of their search was framed mathematically, which is a language that many people are not fluent in, there was a disconnect between the work that was being done in the academy and this large populace that wanted to know what was going on, but was shut out because they didn't speak math. And that drove me to try to come up with various ways, initially through books, but then through other media as well, to bring these cutting-edge ideas out there to a wider world.
And they include things like your TED Talks that have been watched by millions of people, op-eds in the New York Times. But you're also chairman and co-founder of the World Science Festival. What is that? What's that all about?
So the World Science Festival is an organization that I co-founded with Tracy Day, a producer of broadcast television. We founded it back in 2006, with the goal being to create initially a live event in New York City that would change the way in which science programming was done. I mean, the typical science program that you see at various venues, and they're very valuable, doesn't involve the same kind of attention to production detail, the same kind of attention to narrative arc that is lavished on other works of fiction or nonfiction that are not scientific at their core. And we wanted an audience to come to an event, be it on cosmology or neuroscience or sustainability, whatever. We wanted them to come in and to really feel that they were transported to a different place, the way they are when they go to a great Broadway production or if they go to a great film. They feel like they've gone someplace else during those 90 minutes. And we wanted to create that kind of an experience as opposed to the usual, which is, yeah, the ideas tickled my brain. They kind of caused me to think about new things. That's all important. But if science is only experienced cerebrally and not viscerally, you're missing out on a tremendous opportunity.
So is this also part of what you're trying to do with the World Science University? Does it have the same attention to production value and narrative arc?
In a way, I'd say yes. Yeah. So the World Science Festival itself is 5 days of programming that is late May, early June in about 25 venues in New York City. Brings out typically about 200,000 people to the in-theater events, the outdoor events, and it's kind of a real opportunity for an immersion in science, but at a level that doesn't require you to have any background. So you can come in with just curiosity, and you can really feel like you get something out of the programs. World Science U is an extension of the same philosophy, but it's focused on a more dedicated educational focus. So there are opportunities for somebody to delve deeply into Einstein's ideas in special relativity, for instance. That's one of our initial pilot courses, and it's got the full mathematics that you would learn in a university-level course on the subject, but you can take it at home and it's free. And yes, indeed, so the same kind of production values are lavished in the sense of there are enormous number of visuals that take the abstract ideas that Einstein developed and allow you to see them. So you can talk about time slowing for an object in motion, but it's an abstract concept. If, however, you see it visually on the screen, then you have this mental imagery that you can hook your understanding on. So we've created courses of that sort. We've also created a series of what we call master classes, where we've got some of the world's top physicists at the moment, but we're going to be branching out to other sciences too. The very individuals who came up with our cutting-edge understanding of cosmology or string theory or unified theory, they have worked with us to create experiences, again, for the general audience, where you can dive in and go more deeply than you would in, for instance, a World Science Festival program. That's really what distinguishes World Science U from World Science Festival.
And I really want to encourage listeners to go and check this out who might be interested on your website. Speaking of time slowing and Einstein, one of the things that you've done is to write a children's book, Icarus at the Edge of Time, which dramatizes in narrative form one of Einstein's profound insights in relativity theory. Now, my daughter, who's 11, and I, we both read the book, and although we get the story, we don't really understand the science behind it. Can you tell listeners what happens in the story and then explain how it helps to illustrate Einstein's relativity theory?
Sure, absolutely. And I should say at the outset that the point of this book was to allow a broad audience to experience Einstein's ideas at a variety of different levels. So there will be some who fully get the scientific underpinnings. There'll be others who just go on a journey that is something that is exciting and interesting, but you're still left questioning, and then you're motivated to try to figure out the science behind it. But let me just fill in some of the details since we're having the conversation here. So Icarus at the Edge of Time was motivated by my own experience where I learned the classic Greek myth of Icarus that many of us study in elementary school or junior high school. Of course, you've got the boy with the wax wings. His dad says, don't fly too near the sun. And he disobeys his dad and he dies. The wax wings melt and he crashes. And it always bothered me, that story, because it seems to say that if you go against authority, you pay the ultimate price. It's kind of the story of social control. And especially as I got older and became a scientist, I realized that you can't make a great breakthrough unless you're willing to not do what you're told, unless you're willing to break all the rules. So that kind of inspired a futuristic reimagining of the tale, which is what Icarus at the Edge of Time is all about, in which I imagine that a boy would fly to the edge of a black hole, again against his father's warning, and what would happen would be driven by real science. Even though it's a fictional tale, of course, the story would be driven by real science. In this case, as you mentioned, Einstein's general theory of relativity, which shows us that when you experience a strong gravitational field, time itself slows down. So the boy goes to the edge of a black hole where gravity is strong, and his clock ticks off slowly. His body ages slowly compared to everybody else who's not near the black hole. So, spoiler alert, what happens is he spends only an hour at the edge of the black hole, but when he comes back and wants to find his dad, he learns that his dad and everything else that he knew has been gone for 10,000 years, because an hour for him was 10,000 years for everybody else. So it's a story in which real science drives what happens, and it reimagines the original myth because the boy doesn't die, of course, but he does have to acclimate to a vastly new reality. And that's what science is about. You have a breakthrough. You don't die for it, of course, but you do often have to acclimate to a new reality that your discovery has created.
Now I want to dig in a little bit more into some of these ideas, and you'll correct me when I get any of the science wrong, but as I understand it, Einstein rethought the nature of space-time, and the consequences of his theory of gravity were cosmological reframing how we understand the fabric of the cosmos. At least one other key development, because you've talked a little bit about relativity, that followed from Einstein is quantum theory, which focuses on the atomic and subatomic level. Can you explain a little bit about quantum mechanics and what it helps us to understand?
Sure. Your description is right on target. What we found going back to roughly 1905 through 1930, a period of tremendous development in our understanding of physics, is that the microscopic realm plays by rules that nobody had any inkling of prior to this creative period in science. Everybody pretty much thought that baseballs behave in a certain way that is described well by the laws that Isaac Newton wrote down in the late 1600s, and we still teach to high school students around the world. Everybody pretty much thought that those laws that work for baseballs would also work for molecules and atoms and electrons and subatomic particles. But that turned out not to be the case, and not to be the case in a very big way, because as science began to pry apart the atom and examine its constituents and how they behave, they found that the rules that Newton wrote down just didn't work. They didn't describe what happened. So a generation of physicists came up with a new set of laws that do describe the micro world and quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is the new understanding that they brought forward. And in two sentences, the critical new idea of quantum physics is that you can't predict the outcome of an experiment with absolute definitive certainty in the guise that Newton gave us. In other words, Newton would say, "Tell me how you hit the baseball, and I will tell you where it will land. Definitively, I'll tell you where it will land." Quantum theory says that that mode of reasoning is not actually correct, and the error when you try to apply that reasoning to the micro world becomes enormous. Quantum theory says the best you can ever do is predict the probability, the likelihood that the electron will be here or there or way over there. And that's the best you can do according to quantum physics, just predicting probabilities.
From what I understand it, though, there's some real weirdness that happens once probability enters into this. Can you give us a little bit of a sense of some of the weirdness that comes out of quantum mechanics? Why is it so different from our intuitive understanding of reality?
Well, I mean, take an example. If you're in a room, which I suspect you are, some studio right now, and there's probably a door that's closed. And if you walk into that closed door, you and your intuition and Isaac Newton would all say you'd hit the door and you'll just bounce right off. That's what will happen. And the weirdness of quantum theory is that when probabilities come into the story, there can be a small probability that something unexpected can happen. So for instance, when you take a little electron and you fire it into a door, into a barrier that it can't penetrate according to the older ideas of physics, quantum theory in certain circumstances says that there actually is a small probability that the electron can penetrate that barrier. And the amazing thing is when you do the experiment over and over again, most of the time the electron doesn't penetrate, but sometimes it actually does, realizing that small probability that it could actually pass right through. So that kind of weirdness that something can tunnel from one location to another in a manner that anybody from Isaac Newton through the great physicist prior to quantum theory would say is absolutely impossible, quantum theory says is possible, and it actually happens. And a small little footnote, should any of this sound esoteric or somehow interesting but not relevant to everyday life, let me point out that the very fact that you have a cell phone and a personal computer and all the wonderful technological wizardry of the modern age, all of that relies upon the integrated circuit, which itself relies upon quantum physics that allows us to understand how to guide the motion of electrons through these tiny circuits that are sitting inside all those devices. So this stuff is not pie in the sky. This new understanding of reality from quantum physics has changed our everyday lives in a profound way.
Brian, if you'll permit the metaphor, the holy grail you've been pursuing for more than a quarter century is to provide a unified field theory that bridges the two pillars of modern physics, general relativity, which we've talked just a little bit about, at least in terms of gravity and time, and quantum mechanics. This was a problem so challenging that Einstein couldn't solve it. Why is it so difficult to bring these two ways of understanding the laws of physics together into a unified theory? Why doesn't relativity theory fit easily with what we've been learning in quantum mechanics?
I'd be happier if it was a simpler problem. And if you ask me, why is it so difficult? The best answer I can give you is that when we look at the laws of big things, as you say, Einstein's general theory of relativity, and we compare those laws to the laws of small things, quantum mechanics that we were just talking about, we find that the language, the concepts, the mathematics of these two pillars of 20th century physics are radically different. If I wrote down the equations and I listed the concepts, you'd say, wow, they don't seem to overlap in any way. They just seem radically distinct. And then when you probe a little bit further, you find that not only are they distinct, but they're actually in some sense mutually contradictory. So the results of a calculation that merges Einstein's ideas of general relativity and those of quantum physics, the results of calculations that try to use both theories simultaneously is usually just utter nonsense. It's garbage. It's numbers like infinity coming out of the calculations, and there's never been a device that's ever measured the number infinity. So we know that result is not curious, it's not interesting, it's just a slap in the face. It's nature grabbing us by the lapels and slapping us back and forth and saying, you guys are doing something very wrong in your attempt to put the laws of the big and small into one coherent package. And you're right, Einstein, in some ways, struggled with this for 30 years, didn't find the answer. We string theorists, the area that I work on, have picked up where Einstein left off and have made what many of us consider great progress, but I wouldn't say that we've solved the problem yet. We are still looking for that single unifying principle that will put all the laws of nature together into one coherent package.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking with world-renowned physicist and mathematician Brian Greene, who'll be joining us in Memphis on March 5th at Rhodes College. So let's talk a little bit about superstring theory. As the title of your institute that you direct makes plain, you're a champion of this approach, or it's now being called M theory by some. Explain what string theory is all about and how, if it is proven, it will provide the unified theory that eluded Einstein and others.
Describing string theory is actually one of the easier tasks for a physicist to do, because whereas quantum mechanics involves all sorts of weird ideas with probability, and general relativity involves strange ideas of curve, space, and warp time, when it comes to string theory, I can describe it in language that can paint a pretty clear picture, I think, of what's going on. So if you take any piece of matter, perhaps the table where you may be sitting right now, and cut off a little chunk of that table, and then cut that chunk into ever smaller pieces, the question is, what's the smallest thing that you will get to by that cutting process? Now, we've learned that ultimately you'll get to molecules, and we know that molecules are made of atoms stuck together in interesting ways. We know that atoms themselves can be pulled apart into electrons that go around a central blob called the nucleus, which itself has particles, neutrons, and protons. And we've even learned that the neutrons and protons have smaller particles inside of them, little particles called quarks. And that is where conventional theoretical ideas, conventional experimental surveys end, that you've basically got little tiny dot particles, quarks, electrons, and a variety of their exotic cousins are the fundamental ingredients. String theory comes along and it suggests, and every time I talk about this, I underscore the fact that this is just a suggestion because this theory is not proven, as you were alluding to. The suggestion is that there's a deeper level to the story, that if you were to closely examine any of these particles, say a little electron, and you were somehow able to look deeply inside, you'd find that there is something else in there. And the something else would be a little tiny filament, a kind of string-like filament of vibrating energy. And the analogy that I love to use is, you know, if you have a violin and you pluck a string, it vibrates, and that vibration produces one or another musical tone. In string theory, the little vibrations of the strings don't produce different musical tones. They produce the different particles. So what that means is an electron in this approach would be a string vibrating in one pattern. A quark would be a string vibrating in a different pattern. A photon would be a string vibrating in a different pattern still. So everything, in a sense, becomes unified because everything emerges from the same kind of entity, these little vibrating strings. That, in a nutshell, is what the theory is about.
Now, you said it's not been proven. I understand that one of the knocks on string theory is that it's not falsifiable. How can string theory be proven experimentally? Is what's happening with the Large Hadron Collider providing some concrete evidence that string theory is onto the right thing? Where do we stand in terms of provability?
You know, it's a key question, and it's also a subtle question that could take up a lot of time to describe all the nuance. So let me give you layer number one of the answer, and if you want to push deeper, we of course can do that. So is it possible that the Large Hadron Collider would find some evidence for string theory? And the answer to that, in principle, is yes. So when you study the equations of string theory, you find that these little vibrational patterns can, in principle, produce the known particles, the electrons and the quarks that we've known about for some time. But there are other vibrational patterns of the strings that can produce other particles that we've never seen. We don't even know if they exist. So it's possible at the Large Hadron Collider that when you slam protons together at very high energy, the energy of the impact can create these new kinds of particles that string theory suggests should be there. So if we should find any of those particles, that wouldn't prove string theory per se, but it would be a very strong piece of circumstantial evidence that these ideas are headed in the right direction. That, in many ways, is the most promising hope for finding evidence of the theory when the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva turns back on to full energy, which will happen shortly, and many of us are hoping that that will happen. I should say I consider it a long shot. I consider it unlikely that this is how things are going to turn out. My guess is that we're still very much at the beginning of understanding string theory, and it will take a lot more theoretical work, a lot more playing with the equations before we have the capacity to really extract some unambiguous feature of the theory that we can go out in the world and look for. Now, does that mean the theory is unfalsifiable? I think that's far too strong a statement, but I would also say that you don't have to actually have a theory that's falsifiable to be doing science. You really have to have a theory that's verifiable. That is, that it gives rise to some feature, and if you see that feature, then you know the theory is correct. And my suspicion is that string theory will become ever closer to that goal, and it may actually reach it. But that is one of the beauties of theoretical and experimental research in science. You just don't know. And for some people, that's sufficiently off-putting that they want to work on something else where they know that within 2 years or 3 years, they'll have the answer if their ideas are correct or not. For string theory, you have to have a certain kind of internal fortitude to be able to work on ideas that you just don't know if they're right or wrong, and you may not get the answer even in your own lifetime. There are some who find that a direction, an approach that is just untenable. It doesn't fit with their scientific DNA, and that's perfectly fine.
So I want to talk a little bit more about how you do end up getting there, and I want to talk a little bit more about playing with equations, as you've just put it. String theory depends upon the idea that our usual way of thinking about reality, which is that it has three dimensions of space and one of time, doesn't add up. And it postulates that there are 10 dimensions of space, 7 of which are curled up on scales so tiny that microscopic doesn't come close to doing their size justice. Do I understand it correctly that it's through the math that you're required to suggest that there are these never-before-apprehended dimensions that exist, since this is what makes some of your equations work? And then, if that's right, then is math the key to understanding reality? Is it the Rosetta Stone of the universe?
So your description, again, is right on target. When we study the equations of string theory, we find that those equations tell us that if this theory is correct, then the usual three dimensions of common experience that you can flat-footedly call left, right, back, forth, and up, down, or length, width, and height, those three spatial dimensions cannot exhaust all of the spatial dimensions. Which is a strange-sounding idea because most of us, when we walk around in everyday life, that's all that we see, left, right, back, forth, and up, down. So how can there possibly be other dimensions? And I've studied this question for decades now, as have many of my colleagues. We do have potential answers to that question. But getting back to your question, yes, it does all come from the mathematics. It all comes from writing down the equations of the theory, analyzing them, ensuring that those equations don't give illogical, self-contradictory results. And when you place those restrictions, you are led to this idea of more dimensions than the ones that we directly see.
So again, is math for you the key to understanding reality?
It's a good question. And I would say that for me and many of my colleagues, string theory is an example of a theory that illustrates the power of mathematical insight. Now, does that mean that mathematics is the only tool that theorists will use to analyze reality? I don't know the answer to that. You know, part of me wants to simply say, yes, absolutely. The universe is fundamentally mathematical. Therefore, we use mathematics to analyze it, to study it, and that is the way forward. Now, certainly that kind of a statement resonates well with the history of ideas in theoretical science. All the way back from the time of Isaac Newton and even earlier, mathematics has proven itself to be a spectacularly sure-footed guide into realms of reality, which at the time that the math was being undertaken might not have been accessible to us. We might not have had the equipment available to look at the parts of reality that the math was in principle describing. And yet then when we did develop the technology to study time and electromagnetic waves and to study the universe through telescopes revealing black holes and the expansion of space, all of the ideas that I just listed came previously from mathematical analysis that predicted those features, which were subsequently confirmed. So that is a tremendous reservoir of data showing us that math does a really good job at describing reality. But could I imagine, at least in principle, that sometime in the distant future, maybe we contact some kind of alien civilization and they say to us, hey, what have you guys been doing to analyze the universe? And we show them all of our mathematical equations. Is it possible that they might turn to us and say, ah, we tried math too for a while, but it's actually not the right way of going about it. And then they show us a radically different approach. I can at least allow for that possibility. But were you to push me and say, well, what would that new thing look like? I can't even imagine what it would be, because mathematics is the language of pattern, and reality and observation seems to focus on repetitive patterns, that the Earth goes around the sun, that the Earth spins on its head, that these kind of phenomena happen over and over again, and math is really good at capturing those patterns. What other approach would capture the patterns but do something else? I don't know, but that probably is just a failure of my own creativity to think about what it might be.
And I have to say, I can completely understand exactly what you're saying. When I've heard you say that we need to follow the math and see where it takes us, you say the Earth going around the sun, but that's not intuitively how we actually experience the universe. Of course, we experience it as if it's centered on the Earth and that the sun revolves around us, and it's on the basis of math from Copernicus forward that we understand something about the nature of the reality of the universe as it is. Now, I want to take us back to the beginning of the universe and talk a little bit about some of the ways in which ideas about the Big Bang seem to be changing. I understand that some of your recent work has shifted from discussions of the Big Bang to many Big Bangs, one of which created our universe and others that created other universes. This is the notion of multiverses. Can you explain why we need to postulate the idea that there are many universes beyond our own?
Well, again, the first thing to underscore is that we are now in highly speculative territory, but that's fine. And it follows naturally on the conversation of mathematics that we had just a moment ago, because since roughly 1970s, 1980s, scientists have been struggling, working very hard to answer, in some sense, a very basic question, which is, if the universe began with the Big Bang, what is it that banged? What was the fuel? What drove the outward swelling of space in the first place? And since about 1980, there's been a proposal on the table. It's called the inflationary theory of cosmology. And this theory posits that a little nugget of space can be filled with a kind of energy that gives rise to a repulsive gravity, an anti-gravity, a negative gravity, an outward pushing gravity. And according to these ideas, that is what drove the outward swelling of space. Now, when you then study that theory mathematically, you find something curious. It's very difficult, almost impossible, to fully use up that fuel, that energy that gives rise to this repulsive gravity. So some of that fuel drives the outward swelling that we would call the Big Bang that created our universe, but there's some of that fuel left over. In fact, the swelling of space generates more of that fuel. And if there's more of that fuel, that means there can be more Big Bangs. And each Big Bang generates more of that fuel as a residual, if you will, that yields Big Bang after Big Bang after Big Bang, universe after universe after universe, with our universe simply being one of that grand collection.
I have to say, as a scholar who writes a lot about existentialism, I was hooked by the opening of The Fabric of the Cosmos. You tell the story of pulling Albert Camus' The Myth of Sisyphus off your father's dusty old bookcase. Now, this is one of the classics of existentialism, in which Camus insists that the fundamental question of life is, what makes it worth living? Does understanding theoretical physics make a difference to ordinary people who only live in four dimensions?
Well, I think the answer to that is yes, because my feeling is that if you are going to embark on a journey to try to answer that question, is life worth living? What is it that makes life worth living? You need to have the fullest sense of what life is. You need to have the fullest sense of what reality is. And what physics does for us is it takes us closer to that complete sense of how the world works and why the world is here and how the world evolves. And I just cannot see how anybody can make a reasoned argument or decision about whether or not life is worth living if you don't have some grasp of the underlying principles within which your life is being led. You don't have some deep understanding of even the nature of the reality that you inhabit. And that is what physics takes us toward. And that's why I think these ideas are not just esoteric, interesting things to contemplate. Rather, they can really inform our grasp of who we are and how we fit in.
Isn't it even more than this? I mean, it seems as if so many public policy issues today actually depend on understanding something about the basic principles of modern science. And if people aren't informed enough, at least to be able to be informed citizens to vote responsibly on these kinds of issues, there's something amiss in our democratic process when it comes to these sorts of issues. Isn't that part of the issue as well?
It is. It's kind of a step in a somewhat different direction from the meaning of life and whether life is worth living to the political process. But I absolutely agree with you that it does extend there as well, because there are so many issues and opportunities. And you can just rattle some of them off, from climate change to alternate energy to new food production process to genetically modified foods, to what we do with nuclear waste, to the opportunities with space travel. Should it be manned travel or should it be robotic? To the possibilities of nanoscience, personalized medicine. I could go on forever, right? But each and every one of these things which I just listed has science at its core. So if you're going to start making decisions about these things and you don't have a grasp of the underlying science, then you are completely ill-equipped to make strong, good, rational decisions. So what does that mean? So if the average person doesn't engage with the underlying science, then they are basically punting on being part of the process. They are shifting it all to a small number of individuals who themselves may or may not have been informed by the underlying science and have their decision being informed by those key underlying ideas. So in a sense, the health of democracy rests on a public that is engaging with the underlying science, at least to an extent that they have some feel for the issues that are driving many of the decisions that are going to be made going forward.
And in part, this really is going to depend on people like you who can bring these kinds of ideas to a broader public. Brian Green, we've learned so much today about why understanding modern science is important and a little bit about understanding some of the latest ideas in theoretical physics. We look forward to learning even more when you join us in Memphis on March 5th at 6 p.m. at Rhodes College. Thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.